So it's about time we got started, so if everyone can take a seat now, please. Thanks. Okay, so today's lecture, we have to finish off a little bit of the basic phenomenology, well, not some important parts of the basic phenomenology that I didn't get to last time. In particular, entanglement and the EPR paradox are obviously big topics in the foundations of quantum mechanics. Then I'm going to move on to the next section of the course, which is about the generalized formalism for quantum theory in terms of density operators, completely positive maps, and things like that. I know that you've seen some of this before. One of the reasons for doing it again here is I want to do it in a sort of conceptually different sort of style. And I also want to make the point that you can distinguish how you build the formalism between what I was calling the church of the larger Hilbert space picture and the church of the smaller Hilbert space picture. So here you can sort of conceptually separate different approaches to building the formalism. What I'm actually going to do today is a lot of sort of pre-prep mathematics preparation for that. Some of this you'll be familiar with, but I'm going to present it in a sort of slightly different way. Okay. So entanglement and the EPR paradox. So I'm sure that you all know that this starts in 1935 with a paper by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. Here is a quote from Schrödinger, a famous quote from Schrödinger, in which he says that he would call entanglement not one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. And here he's pointing out the idea that when you have an entangled state, you can no longer think of it as composed of individual states for the two systems on their own. Contrast this with Feynman's views, right? So for every strange feature of quantum mechanics, you can probably find somebody who thinks that's the one characteristic important feature of quantum theory. Okay, so just some review, what's entanglement? Well, if you have two systems, system A and system B, they each have their own state space, a Hilbert space, HA or HB, then the joint system lives in the tensor product Hilbert space. Okay, what's the tensor product Hilbert space? It's just the set of all states that can be written as a linear combination of direct products here between basis states of A and B. Okay, so we call a state a product state if you can find a way of writing it as just a direct product of a state on A and a state on B. In this situation, you can straightforwardly assign a state vector to each of the systems individually. Otherwise, we call it an entangled state. Now, if you remember the orthodox interpretation, in the orthodox interpretation, the only things that are properties of the system are observables of which it's an eigenstate. So when you are in an entangled state like this, it's the case that there's no observable on system A alone, apart from the identity operator. There's no observable on system A alone or system B alone that that thing is an eigenstate of. Okay, so in some sense, according to the orthodox interpretation, A and B have no individual properties in that case. There are only joint properties, only observables that that aren't direct products that live in this space. Okay, so let's look at the case of two qubits. So if we have two qubits, I can write out a general state like this in terms of four coefficients. It's fairly easy to show that this is a product state. I'll change that when I later on. This is a product state if and only if this condition holds on the coefficients, right? So the way you prove that is if it's a product state, I have to be able to write it as, let's see. I have to be able to write it as alpha 0 plus beta 1 tensor product gamma 0 plus delta 1. I have to be able to write it like that in terms of two vectors with their own parameters. And if you multiply that out and set these parameters equal to these ones, you'll find that the only way you can do that is if and only if this condition holds. Okay, so when that condition doesn't hold for two qubits, you know that the state's definitely entangled. So in particular, this state here is an entangled state because alpha 0, 1 and alpha 1, 0 in this case are both 0, and these two are both 1 over root 2. So that's an example of an entangled state. So this particular entangled state has an interesting property. So if I look at these two Pauli operators, so the Pauli X operator and the Pauli Z operator, I'm ignoring the Pauli Y operator for now, and I look at an observable that's in the XZ plane. Okay, so N here is a unit vector in the XZ plane, and it only has X and Z components. I can look at the eigenstates of this observable. Okay.
I'm not sure I understand. The product of the weights seems to be equal?
Yes. So this times this has to equal this times this.
So in the case of the state below, we have 1/2 times.
Yeah, so I've got 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, and I've got 0 times 0. So I made a mistake here. Not entangled. Yeah, this should say product here. Sorry.
So what's the
opposite of the state?
Okay, it's not entangled.
Yeah, it's not entangled. Sorry. I'll correct that when I later on upload these slides. Okay, so back, is that clear? Okay. Right, so if we consider a Pauli observable that's just in the XZ plane, then we can look at the two eigenstates, the plus and minus one eigenstates of that observable, and then it turns out that you can show that this same state can be written in that basis like this. So this state in the XZ plane is perfectly correlated in every basis in the XZ plane. It's more complicated if you look at observables which have a Y component too, but it has perfect correlations. Okay, so now we need to sort of briefly review what happens when I make a measurement on one subsystem. So if I measure just one of the subsystems, say subsystem A, in some complete orthonormal basis, then after the measurement, I'm going to end up in a product state. So what happens is I start with this entangled state. I'm going to take an orthonormal basis for system A, and let's suppose that this outcome phi n is obtained. Then what happens to system B? Well, what I have to do, and I'll explain in a bit more detail where all this comes from later, but if I take the inner product, it's a partial inner product, so I'm only taking the inner product of the A component with this basis vector. So writing that out in terms of the components, it means this. I only inner product with the A component here. And then I take that state and I normalize it. So this is just the norm of the state here. Then that's the updated state of system B. There is an exercise on the tutorial where you go into this in a bit more detail. But the bottom line, in terms of this entangled state here, this particular entangled state, the one with perfect correlations, is if I measure it in the basis 0 versus 1, then system B is going to end up in the state 0 if I find 0 for A, or 1 if I find 1 for A. And more generally, because we have perfect correlations in every basis in the XZ plane, the same will have to be true there as well. It'll be the same mathematics, right? So I'm going to end up with if they're spins, for instance, I'll always find the spins pointing in the same direction anywhere in the XZ plane. So as a result of this, if you measure system A and look at the result, and then you measure the same spin observable on system B, then you know that the result will be the same. So once you've measured system A, looked at the result, you know with certainty what will happen if system B is later measured. You'll always get perfectly correlated results. Okay, so that's the underlying mathematics. Now let's look at the argument that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen gave. So they introduced this, what they called the criterion of reality. So what they said is, if without in any way disturbing a system, we can predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to one, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of reality corresponding to that quantity. Okay. All right, so the difficulty is, of course, this term here, without in any way disturbing a system. How do we guarantee that what we're doing is not disturbing the system in any way? So here there's an appeal to locality, right? So if we have a source of these two qubits in some in this entangled state, and if we send the first qubit off in this direction and the second qubit off in that direction, then we can make measurements of them at space-like separation. Okay, so the idea is there's an appeal to relativity here. If I make a measurement of the system A, then because it's space-like separated from the measurement of system B, it can't in any way influence it if we believe in special relativity, right? So they would say that this is a condition under which once I've made the measurement here, and now can predict with certainty system the outcome of the measurement on system B, they would say that I haven't disturbed system B by doing this. Yes?
Special relativity just says that you can't change the statistics there if you don't actually know the result there. But there is some kind of influence, right?
Special relativity says nothing about quantum mechanics in particular, of course, right? Special relativity says a lot of things, but at least the spirit of special relativity is, part of it is that there shouldn't be any influences that travel faster than the speed of light. So what they're appealing to here is, if there are things called elements of reality, if you believe that there are things called elements of reality, then you would expect in that underlying theory, which is not quantum theory but some deeper theory underlying it, you would expect perhaps that underlying theory to also obey the principles of special relativity. So if there's something called an element of reality, right, then you would expect not to be able to change what those things are at space-like separation. Okay. Imagine...
Why not? Like, Bell inequalities don't disprove special relativity. There is influence faster than the speed of light, it just doesn't change the statistics.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between whether special relativity holds at the operational level, which you're right, of course the statistics, you can't signal faster than light, so the statistics show that, and whether it holds at the level of some supposed underlying physical theory, right? So, for example, Bohmian mechanics is a theory which posits additional variables. You can't say that it obeys special relativity in the sense that in the fundamental theory, the equations aren't Lorentz invariant of the fundamental theory. The particle trajectories, the particles can influence each other faster than the speed of light. Now, when you average over your uncertainty of what's going on at the underlying level, you get statistics which operationally you can't use to send signals. But the fundamental theory itself, the fundamental degrees of freedom, are obeying a theory which isn't Lorentz invariant, and it can't be. Anyway, this is the idea here. Anyway, Bell's theorem we will go into in much more detail next week at some point. Okay, so this is basically their argument. So if you buy the EPR criterion plus the locality argument, then system B must have had an element of reality before system A was measured, because by locality, we say that the measurement at system A couldn't possibly have disturbed system B. Okay, so they say, okay, there must be an element of reality. So the conclusion there is that there's some incompleteness to quantum theory because quantum theory doesn't give you any such elements of reality. Now, if we look at the orthodox interpretation, that's pretty straightforwardly non-local in this context, because it says the only things that exist are the observables of which you're an eigenstate of, right? So what happens when you make a measurement of A? As soon as I make a measurement of A and the collapse happens, the element of reality pops into existence at B. As soon as I update system B to one of these states, now suddenly it has an element of reality that it didn't before, right? Because in the orthodox interpretation, that pure state is an objective property. So that's true of the orthodox interpretation, but what you can say here is really any interpretation in which the outcome of this measurement on B is undetermined before A is measured would also be non-local by the EPR criterion. If you buy the EPR, the EPR criterion of reality and their appeal to locality, right? So if you agree with those two things, then you will say any interpretation in which this isn't determined.
Assuming reality.
I mean, the EPR criterion of here it is. Okay. Right, so this criterion, which is a realist criterion, assumes that there are things called elements of reality, and it gives you a criterion for determining, a sufficient criterion for determining when they exist. Right. So you have to buy that, of course. Okay, so that's basically the argument, and if you've read the EPR paper, you probably, or if you've seen other presentations of it, you may see that it's often given as a much more complicated argument involving some kind of violation of the uncertainty principle. It's not really needed. You know, all you really need is a single measurement in one basis. However, as we noted before, there are perfect correlations in all of these bases. So the same thing would have to be true for all possible measurement directions, because on system A, we could have chosen, or we could choose, to measure any of these observables. And if you did so, then that would enforce that there must be an element of reality corresponding to that for Bob. So if you had all of those elements of reality, that would, of course, violate the uncertainty principle. You're saying there has to be a definite value for all of the observables, at least in the XZ plane of spin measurements. That point is irrelevant to the main argument. It already holds for one measurement. I mean, by the way, this on its own already violates the uncertainty principle for the joint system, right? Because the entangled state, you think you can predict with certainty what, if you did a projector onto the entangled state, that you get a particular outcome with certainty. And from this argument, also this observable, right? Those two observables don't commute. You've already got a violation of the uncertainty principle there. Here you get the violation just for one system, just for system B. However, there is, and I'm not going to go into it now, but there is a slight point to this wrinkle on this argument, because Einstein actually gave many different versions of the EPR argument. You can actually use this part, the fact that all of these observables must have definite values, to show that if you were to try to complete quantum mechanics in the way that EPR envisaged, then it would have to be a psi epistemic theory. Would have to be one in which the quantum state isn't a state of reality. This is a result given in this paper here. I'm not going to go into detail about it. So there is a reason to consider multiple measurements. That's all I'm saying here. So when we get to Bell's theorem, we'll show that you can't complete quantum theory in this way and still and maintain the locality. Anyway. Let's see. Okay. So I'm just going to briefly also talk about the no-cloning theorem, partly because it's something that people talk about a lot these days. Okay, so what's the no-cloning theorem? It says that suppose you have two non-orthogonal quantum states, then I can't copy both of them, basically. There's no physical operation I can do that will give me two copies of the state psi if I input the state psi, and also give me two copies of the state phi if I input the state phi. So some of you might have seen this before, but this mathematics just follows from unitarity, and you end up using the same kind of idea over and over again in various contexts in quantum foundations, so it's worth briefly reviewing it. Okay, so the first thing to say is, at least as we've presented things so far, physical operations have to be unitary. Okay, so a unitary has the same input space and the same output space. So if we're going to model this by unitary interaction, then we have to have two systems to start with and two systems to end up with. So what we'll do is we'll take our system in one of these two states, and then we will append to it another physical system, which is in some fixed state, just an ancilla that we put in some fixed state. Okay, so we don't know whether we've got psi or phi, but we can take another system in a state chi. Okay, so then my cloning operation is going to have to be a unitary operation. So it's going to have to take psi and my fixed input state, and that should map it to two copies of psi. And if I input phi instead, it should map it to two copies of phi. Now, one thing you know about unitary operations is that they preserve inner products, right? So if I take the inner product of this state and this state, then I'm going to get a U dagger U term here, which will be the identity. So the inner product at the output will be the same as the inner product at the input. Okay, so let's do that. So if we look at the left-hand side, take the inner product of this and this, we get this here. And if we look at the inner products of the right-hand sides, then I get the inner product of two copies of phi with two copies of psi. Okay, so if we work that out, this here is going to become the identity operator. So I will just get the inner product of psi of phi with psi and the inner product of chi with itself. On this side, I will get the inner product of phi with psi twice, right? So I'll get one from here and one factor from here. So that'll be the square. This we're assuming is a normalized state vector. So this inner product is just equal to one. So what that says is that this unitary can exist only if the inner product between psi and phi is equal to its square. And that can happen only if the modulus of the inner product is 0 or 1, right? So if this is a number which has modulus somewhere between 0 and 1, then obviously if I square it, I'm not going to get back the same thing. Okay, so this says that the only time this can happen is either if these two states are orthogonal or if they're the same state, okay? In which case, it's pretty easy to construct the unitary that does this. It's the same kind of unitary that we use in the measurement, as we were talking about last time. Okay, so you can't copy general quantum states. So this no-cloning feature is related to a number of other important operational features of quantum theory, right? So suppose you could clone, for instance, then you could, in principle, start with one copy of the state and create as many copies as you like, just apply the cloning operation over and over again. So if you could do that, then you could distinguish non-orthogonal states perfectly. Just create an arbitrarily large number of copies, measure each one, in a variety of different bases, you'd eventually be able to determine what the state is. Okay, so cloning, the fact that we can't clone is good, because otherwise that would contradict the fact that we can't distinguish non-orthogonal states in a single shot. If you could clone, and this is actually the way that the no-cloning theorem was originally discovered, you could signal superluminally in the EPR experiment, right? Because right, so the point is that if Alice measures in, say, this basis, then Bob's state collapses in this basis. If she measures in a different basis, then Bob's state collapses in that basis. Right, so if after Alice's eyes had made this measurement or this measurement, then Bob could clone his state. He could determine what that state is by this method and would be able to detect whether Alice had measured in this basis or that basis. Okay, so the fact that there's no cloning is good because otherwise you would have end up with superluminal signaling. The other thing is you could measure an observable, any observable you like, without disturbing the state of a system. How would you do it? You'd clone the system, right? Create a copy of the state, put that extra copy off to one side, do your measurement on this copy, then throw this away and bring in your spare copy, right? Then you haven't changed the state of the system. And we know that you can't do that. So, you know, no cloning is kind of, in some sense, a fundamental property that is very closely related to all of these things. All of these things are, in some sense, you know, the same as no cloning, in some sense. So it's good that the no cloning theorem holds, otherwise we'd be in a mess with quantum mechanics. But we should if you're trying to do interpretations of quantum theory, you should sort of explain why. You know, in particular, if you're a type of person who thinks that the quantum state is real, there are really quantum states out there, it's a bit puzzling. It's kind of like, well, there's this thing that's really out there, and yet somehow I can't just look at it, right, and make a copy. Anyway, we'll talk about that a bit more later.
Well, because it would violate second law for Shannon entropy.
It would violate second law for Shannon entropy. What would violate second law?
Because we can fulfill.
Well, I mean, if you think that the correct entropy in quantum mechanics is the von Neumann entropy, then the clones have the same entropy. You know, a pure state has entropy zero, right? So it doesn't change the von Neumann entropy. But I'm sure that you can probably get a violation of the second law out of this somehow. You're probably right about that. All right. Okay, so now we're going to move on to another topic, which is the generalized formalism of quantum mechanics. So I know that you've seen some of this before. I'm going to present it in a bit of a different way. What we're going to do today in the remainder is set up some of the initial mathematics. Probably not going to get through as much of this as I planned, but let's see. Okay, so the starting point is to think about vectors and dual vectors. So you're all familiar with the kets and the bras. I meant to draw a bra here of Dirac notation. Okay, and you know this is probably review for some of you, but we often don't emphasize it enough in some sense. These bra vectors, they live in a different vector space from the ket vectors, which is called the dual vector space. So we're often quite careless with the distinction, but I'm going to be doing some things which mean that you need to be very careful about what's a vector and what's a dual vector and things like that. So I'm just going to review that distinction. Okay, so suppose we have a vector space V, which is over a field F. Right? This field, don't need to really know what a field is. It's always going to be either the complex numbers or the real numbers, right? So when I say F, I just mean it's either the complexes or the reals. So sometimes there are cases where I'm going to want to look at real vector spaces. So the dual vector space, which I denote V dagger, is just the set of linear functionals which map vectors to scalars, to numbers, okay? So what I mean by a dual vector is a functional, which maps a vector to a scalar, and it has to be linear, right? So if I have a linear combination of two vectors, then the dual vector gives me the linear combination of the dual vector acting on the two vectors. That's what we mean by the dual vector space. This space is itself a vector space because we can define linear combinations on it in the obvious way. If I have a linear combination of two dual vectors, then that just gives me the number that I would get from applying the two dual vectors and taking the linear combination, right? That makes it into a vector space. So for any vector space, doesn't matter if it has an inner product on it or not, any vector space whatsoever, I can always define the dual vector space, which is in general a different vector space from the original one. However, if we do have an inner product, which we do have in quantum mechanics, then the two vector spaces become isomorphic, the same thing, basically. So to remind you, when you have an inner product, it's a functional which takes in two vectors and gives you a scalar, and it satisfies the usual axioms. So if I'm in the case of real, then this star will mean do nothing. But in general, it's complex conjugation for the complex case. So you have this conjugate symmetry, you have the linearity requirement. These two together means that you're going to be conjugate or antilinear on the first component. And then you have the positivity requirement. So this should all be familiar. So as far as we're concerned, if you have a vector space with an inner product, that's what I mean by a Hilbert space. If you are in infinite dimensional case, then there are a couple of other analytic requirements, but I'm not going to worry about infinite dimensions here, just so that we can prove, in the finite dimensional case, everything I can prove like rigorously, but everything does work out in the infinite dimensional case. Okay, so when I have a Hilbert space, I usually use this curly H symbol, as I have been doing so far, rather than V for a vector space, which doesn't necessarily have an inner product. Okay, so if we have an inner product, then there is an isomorphism between the Hilbert space and its dual. Okay, so given a vector, we can construct a dual vector, and given a dual vector, we can construct a vector, and that they're in one-to-one correspondence. So how do you do that? Well, if you have a vector, then you can define a dual vector by saying it's the action, well, it's what I get by inner producting psi with phi, right? So because of the linearity of the inner product, because of this axiom here, that definitely defines a linear functional, okay? So this psi bra psi here can now be thought of as defining a dual vector, a linear functional on the set of vectors. Then we need to go the other way as well. So if you have a dual vector, the easiest way to do this is to just figure out the components of the vector in the basis. So let's suppose this is an orthonormal basis. Then I can define the action of the dual vector, right, on the basis vectors. This is going to give me some numbers. And if I take basically the complex conjugates of those numbers and look at that linear combination of basis vectors, that is a vector in the original space. So I've gone from a dual vector to a vector in H. The reason why I'm writing it in this kind of notation will become clear a bit later, but it just means take the complex conjugates of these numbers. Okay. So not going through the full details, but it's straightforward to prove that if you go this way and then go that way or the other way around, you get back to the same place. So there's one-to-one correspondence between vectors and dual vectors when you have an inner product. So you can think of the inner product in the following way, as we do in Dirac notation. You take the inner product of two vectors, you take the first vector, construct its dual, then act with the dual on the second vector. That's what taking an inner product means. Okay, is there any questions about that? Okay, so now tensor products. Okay, so, I mean, we've seen some of this before, but just to review. Suppose I have two Hilbert spaces, and this one has some orthonormal basis of J vectors, this one has some orthonormal basis of K vectors. What that means is that any vector in this space can be written in terms of components like this. Any vector here can be written in terms of components like this. By the tensor product, it's just the vector space formed by, if I form these direct products and call those things vectors, and I take the linear span of all such things, then that's what I mean by the tensor product space. Okay? So that's a vector space. I've defined a vector space. I have linear, I know how to linearly add things, basically. We still need to know that it's actually a Hilbert space. It needs an inner product. But it just inherits its inner product from the two factor spaces. So the way you do that is you just say, okay, well, I suppose I've got this vector here, and I've got this vector here. If I want to take their inner product, then what I do is I just basically dualize this vector. So I've got to turn these kets into bras. And I've got to take the complex conjugate of these components. And then I just act in the natural way, right? For the direct product states, I just take the product of the individual inner products. And then I just take the linear sum of all that stuff. Okay, so these guys are going to give me delta functions. So I'm just going to end up with another mistake. I need to put this in such a way that I can, I wonder if I can do this on the fly.
Maybe you can just put UV on
this. That should be JK, anyway. It should be, because you're going to get delta functions from those inner products. All right. Okay. All right, so we can obviously iterate this construction as much as many times as you like. I can take the tensor product of many different factor spaces, and then I'm going to end up with very cumbersome notation. Where I'm going to have to keep track of long strings of these Dirac kets. So it becomes useful to develop a sort of more compact notation, which is very similar, basically the same, as the kind of abstract intex notation that you use in GR, right? So at least those of you who are attending the lecture before this have seen stuff like this before. So. How does this work? So for a vector, I'm going to instead of keeping track of this whole object, just keep track of the components, basically. But there's an important distinction. I also need to keep track of the Hilbert space label. Why? Because the Hilbert spaces I'm taking tensor products of might have different dimensions. So HA might have a different dimension from HB. And I can't take inner products of an object on HA with an object on HB. Okay, so unlike when you're doing sort of GR, where all of your tensor components have four possible values, all of the indices have four possible values, here they may vary depending on the dimension of the Hilbert space. So I'm going to add to this index a label, another label, which says, this index refers to Hilbert space A. So instead of writing down this whole thing, I'm going to write this thing. So, and as you note, vectors, just as in the sort of GR type notation, vectors are going to have upper indices. A dual vector, on the other hand, I'm going to do the same sort of thing. I'm just going to keep track of the component and the subsystem label, and dual vectors are going to have lowered indices. Okay, so then when I take an inner product, what really happens is that I am contracting these two indices, and I'm just adopting the usual Einstein summation convention for repeated indices. So instead of having to write a sum over J here, if I have two indices which are the same and they have the same Hilbert space label, then I can contract them. Okay, so I only can contract upper A-type indices with lower A-type indices. So is that clear? Anybody got any questions about that? All right, so then if we're in a tensor product space, then I'm going to have two indices, right? So this would become an object with two upper indices with potentially different Hilbert space types, right? So these indices may range over different numbers of values. And the dual vectors would have two lower indices. And if I take the inner product on this tensor product space, then I have to contract both indices. So this means I'm doing a sum over both j and k. However, just to emphasize the point, this thing wouldn't be a valid contraction. I can't contract, although this is a lower index and this is an upper index, they refer to different Hilbert spaces, maybe different dimensions. So this is not a valid, this thing isn't a valid contraction. It's not an inner product. All right, so basically it's very much like the notation we used to in GR, except we have an extra constraint on what can be contracted. The indices may have different numbers of values. Okay, so now we can do something a bit more interesting. So both a Hilbert space and the dual of a Hilbert space, they're both just Hilbert spaces, right? They're vector spaces within the products. There's no reason why I can't take the tensor product of any two Hilbert spaces I like. So why don't we consider what happens when you take the tensor product of the Hilbert space A and the dual of the Hilbert space B? So this means this is a space of Ketz and this is a space of Bras. Okay, so this will be the vector space formed by objects of this form. And when I write that in an abstract index notation, it's just going to have one upper index referring to the vector component and one lower index referring to the dual vector component. Okay, so what's the dual space to this? Well, if I want to construct the dual space, then what I'm going to have to do is take the dual of this Hilbert space, and that's just take the duals of the two components, right, as we'll see. So the dual of HA tensor HB dagger is HA dagger tensor HB. So that's going to be an object which looks like this. Okay, so again, it's got one upper and one lower index. So there's a natural way of acting this on this. I'm just going to, the two A components have a bra here and a ket here, and I have a ket here and a bra here. So I can just contract those two indices. And the inner product on that space is just going to be given by contracting both of those indices. Okay, so that's sort of an unusual thing to do. You don't necessarily often think about this space in quantum mechanics, but it's there in quantum mechanics. So this is a little bit tricky. So if I consider objects in this space, it's not a pure ket or a pure bra in a primitive sense, right? It's not the tensor product of two ket spaces or the tensor product of two bra spaces. However, it's still just a Hilbert space. It's a vector space within a product like any other. So you can, if you want, think of this space as in some sense being a space of kets and this space as in some sense being a space of bras, if you like. There's no reason. Any pair of vector space versus dual vector space, I can think of one as a space of kets and one as a space of bras if I like. Okay, so when I'm doing that, I'm going to use round brackets as opposed to these pointy brackets. Just as an indication here, I want to think of this as the fundamental vector space, this one. So I can think of it as a fundamental vector space, and I can think of this as its dual, a space of rounded bras. And then I can write this inner product again as an action of a dual vector on a vector in a Dirac kind of notation. So sometimes it will be useful to decompose things that way. And I can do that for any Hilbert space and its dual. Right? Think of one as a set of Ketz and the other one as a set of Bras. Okay. All right, so I'm throwing a lot of notations at you today. Let's throw you one more notation. So clearly, I can iterate this construction and consider very complicated tensor product spaces, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 components here, some of which are daggered and some of which are not. In abstract index notation, you get a bunch of tensors, basically, with loads of indices on them. So sometimes even this is a bit cumbersome, and it's useful to have also a diagrammatic notation. So here's one way I can do it. So I'm going to represent a tensor, like this kind of object, just by a box. A box can be of arbitrary shape. It can have any number of surfaces. If it has a vector index like this one, I'm just going to represent it by a line that sticks out one of the upper surfaces of the box. So it has to be upwards oriented. And a dual gets represented by a downwards oriented line. So the actual topology of the box, the shape of the box doesn't matter. And where I put the lines doesn't matter. It's just whether they're downwards oriented or upwards oriented. So here, this particular tensor needs to have two upward oriented lines, which are labeled by which Hilbert space they refer to, and three downward ones. So here's one way of representing it. I could draw a more complicated looking box and draw it like this, or I could draw the same thing and put the lines in different places. So that topology doesn't matter. All that matters is that vector indices stick out of upward oriented surfaces, dual vector indices out of downward oriented surfaces. Have I absolutely lost everyone yet? No. Yes? OK. Do you want to ask any questions?
No,
that's fine. OK. So then what you can do is represent an inner product just by joining the lines, because a dual index is going to be contracted with a vector index that is get contracted with dual indices. One will be an upward line and one will be a downward line. So I can, for instance, represent inner product of these two things in these two dual spaces just by a diagram like that. So this is going to be helpful for thinking about when I do contractions, what kind of object am I going to end up with? We'll see that in a minute. Okay, so now here's where it gets more useful. So you could also define partial inner products, and this just means only contract over some of the indices, right? So some of the components are going to survive. So for example, let's consider an object that's in this tensor product of HA, dual space on HB, HC, versus an object that's defined on BCD, right? So when I contract, so I can contract over the B and C components, because this is B, this is its dual, this is C, this is its dual, so those will contract. The other two indices won't be able to contract. So if I take this object and I contract over the B indices and the C indices, then I'll be left with something that has one vector index on A, one dual vector index on D. So in the diagrammatic notation, that's going to look like this. So the Cs and the Bs get contracted, A and D is left over. So I end up with an object that's on the tensor product of HA dual with HD. Okay, does that make sense? Somewhat. At least one person's nodding, so that's okay. Right. Oops. Okay. Now, we can, as you're used to doing in GR, raise and lower indices. How do we do that? We do it by taking a partial inner product with a vector like this. So let's consider this vector. This vector looks like the maximally entangled state, the entangled state we were talking about earlier, only there's no normalization factor. This is like an unnormalized entangled state. I can write it in terms of the Kronecker delta. So this is the symbol that's 1 if j is equal to k. and zero otherwise, right? So those two are the same thing. So as an abstract index object, it's going to be written like this. Now, you can write this as a box with two things coming up if you want, but it's very useful in the diagrammatic notation to write this thing as a bent line. Because what you can see is if I act a vector, well, if I act a dual vector here, then it's going to convert it into a vector, right? So if I put a vector on this component, dual vector on this component, then it's going to get flipped and become a vector. This is how it looks in abstract index notation, right? So if I contract these k's, then, oops. Ah, man, another mistake. This should be a j here, right? So it should be, let's see, delta ja ka psi ka is going to give me an object psi ka. J. See, same mistake twice. Yeah.
Shouldn't there be some sort of complex conjugation also?
That's coming, right? So this raising is just all this does is it flips bras into kets. Flips bras into kets. It doesn't do the complex conjugate, right? So this is not the same as mapping a vector to its dual vector, which we'll see in a minute. I can also consider the other way round, right? So the dual vector this is like proportional to a projector onto that state. That's going to turn kets into bras, right? So in abstract index notation, again, I've screwed up the j. This should be a j here. That's why you should use diagrammatic notation. It's very difficult to make those sorts of mistakes. Yeah. Well, the order of the indices doesn't really matter, right? They're labeled with which system they refer to anyway. So you can do whatever you like topologically with the diagrams, really.
But you said you can't contract them when they're swapped.
I can't contract an A index with a B index. I can always contract an A index with an A index. Doesn't matter where it appears. Okay, so now taking duals. Okay, so this transition is not the same as this one, as was pointed out, because there's a complex conjugate involved here. And it is if you're in a real Hilbert space, right? If the field is real, they're the same thing. But if we're in the complex case, you have to change bras to kets, and you have to take the complex conjugate of coefficients, right? So the dual, what I mean by the dual vector, which I'm going to denote by a dagger, is I first take these components, complex conjugate them, and then I contract with the lowering. Okay, so this is the correspondence between psi and its dual. The reason for decomposing it like this is if I have a tensor with many, many, many indices, then I can raise and lower indices individually. I can't take the dual of individual subspaces, because I can only do the complex conjugate once on the whole space, right? So when I'm taking a dual, it has to be I'm taking the dual of the whole great big thing. Whereas a raising and lowering, you can do component by component. Okay, we've got 5 minutes, so I probably won't get through all of this. But the point of this is that you can just use the mathematics of an elementary Hilbert space on any Hilbert space you like. It doesn't have to be the usual boring one. Okay, so this is the usual boring Hilbert space that you see in quantum mechanics, space of pure quantum states. It's just the boring old space of kets, right? So you have a ket, that corresponds to an upper index thing or this diagram. And if you have multiple subsystems, then you're in a tensor product of a bunch of ket spaces, loads of upper indices, loads of things coming out the top of a box. But it still just kets all the way, so it's a relatively boring space. Now let's consider a more interesting space. This is the probably last thing I'll do. So this is the space of linear operators. So let's consider the space of operators that map me from vectors on HA to vectors on HB. I'm going to denote this space as L, linear operators that act this way, right? So if the input and output spaces are the same, if I'm just mapping from one Hilbert space to the same Hilbert space, then I'll just write it like this. Okay, so what's an operator? Well, you know how to write an operator in terms of its matrix elements, right? In Dirac notation, you can write down the matrix elements of an operator in some basis for system A, basis for system B, and then you know that you can write the operator like this. Okay, that's conventional. But hang on a minute, this is just what looks exactly like what we previously called HB tensor HA dual. Right, which is apart from the fact that when we do this, we tend to put a tensor product symbol in here. But the structure of that state space, that space is the same, right? It's a bunch of components, a vector and a dual vector, and take the linear sum. Right? So this kind of thing would be an abstract notation represented like this, and would look like a box like this. And hey, this looks like, if you're familiar with circuit diagrams, this looks a bit like how you would think about an operation in a circuit diagram. That's no accident in the diagrammatic notation. So these two spaces really are the same, right? As linear spaces, as vector spaces, they're the same space. Okay. So we can think of an operator as an element of this. And then if you do that, it turns out that when you act M on a vector, that's just the same as the partial inner product. So if you have an operator written like this and a vector, well, usually if I act with the operator on the vector, I'm going to take the inner products of these things with these things and then sum over everything. That's just the partial inner product of these two things, right? It's just going to look like this. It's going to be a contraction over these two indices, and that will leave me with a vector on. I think I've labeled A and B wrongly here. The A's and B's should be flipped on this. But basically, it's going to look like this diagrammatically, right? So, okay. So the general idea is that if you have the space of linear operators from one space to another space, then that's the same thing, isomorphic to, you take the dual of the input space, tensor product it with the output space, that's the same thing as the space of operators from HA to HB. So that means that you can think of everything you have to do in quantum mechanics in terms of tensor products and taking partial inner products on tensor product spaces. Now this is the last thing I'll say. So since this space here, is just a Hilbert space, we've seen it's got an inner product, that means that there's an inner product on this space. Set of operators has an inner product on it. Okay, so how are we going to find it? Well, there's a general prescription for taking inner products. Take two vectors, turn one of them into its dual, act with the dual on the vector, that gives you the inner product. So this is a sort of unnecessary terminology here a bit, but the dual of an operator, right? So the operator vector space has a dual space, right? It's the space of linear functionals from operators to scalars. So it's the dual space of operators. It's a duperator, if you like, okay? So this is the space of operators from A to B. Its dual is HA tensor HB dagger. Or in other words, the dual of the space of operators from HA to HB is the space of operators from HB to HA, right? So the duperators from A to B are the operators from B to A. Same thing. Okay, so, and now we construct the inner product. So if you have an operator, like this, and you have another operator, right, from A to B, then the first thing I do is I dualize this thing. So what I have to do is I have to take the complex conjugate, and then I have to swap, I have to raise this index and lower this index and take the complex conjugate. So that's this. Okay, so that's what this object is. This is the dagger of the operator. This is the usual Hermitian adjoint of the operator. And then if I contract those two things, then what I get is just the trace of the dagger of this operator times that operator. So that's often called the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product of two operators. But there's nothing fancy. It's just the usual inner product on this space. It's the inner product inherited from these two spaces. It's not some fancy new inner product that we just invented. It's the usual Hilbert space. It's the one that's inherited from the Brouwer and Ketz spaces. Okay, so this is what we use as an inner product for operators. Okay, I better stop there, and we'll continue it next time.